session number 10044, reel 2.
Mr. Powell, reel 2.
It was as somebody imbued with the vision of a British Empire, unique but potentially tough and resilient, that I retraversed the journey from Darwin to London by flying boat. It was a journey which the stages became shorter and the timings became longer as we approached a Europe which was already at war, though I do remember an interlude when, it having been discovered that I was Professor of Greek at the University of Sydney, the flying boat crew and the few passengers who were on the flight insisted that we stopped off an extra 3 hours in Athens so that I could take them round the Acropolis. Now, it so happened that, having been a grammatical rather than an archaeological scholar, I'd never been on the Greek mainland. However, the Acropolis bore a sufficient resemblance to what I knew about it from books that I was able to acquit myself without exposing too much ignorance. So one arrived eventually, and with great joy, in a blacked-out England, somewhere around, this must be somewhere around the 22nd of September 1939.
Had the atmosphere changed amongst the people?
It was an England at war. It was an England under the blackout. It was an England which hadn't yet discovered that it could live with war, and to which war was still an unknown and therefore a terrifying quantity. However, I returned to my parents' home in Seaford in Sussex, where my books and all my possessions were that I'd left behind when I went to Australia, and I set out to get myself recruited. There was a special reason for urgency in doing so. I had, in the winter of 1938-1939, been appointed Professor of Greek and Classical Literature in the University of Durham, my appointment to commence from the 1st of January 1940, and I viewed with dread the gradual approach of the 1st of January 1940, when, had I taken up that appointment, I might have found myself irretrievably non-combatant for one means or another, and combatant I was somehow determined to be. So I frequented recruiting stations with no success at all for 4 or 5 weeks. Recruitment was not taking place, and someone who hadn't even got Certificate A and who had no pre-war training was not wanted. There was, I remember, a clerkship at Chatham that was vacant, but I passed that one up. However, about the middle of October, and I forget in what circumstances, I became aware that Australia House had made an agreement with the British government. Since many Australians were coming to Britain who had found their way home in order to fight in what they assumed was November 1918 going on, and were actually starving because they couldn't get into the forces. An agreement that on a person being certified, duly certified as Australian, he would as such be recruited into the British Army in the regiment of his choice. So on the 20th of October 1939, I went to Australia House, announced myself as the Professor of Greek in the University of Sydney, and claimed to be, for the purposes of the agreement with the British government, an Australian. So they used the usual Australian phrase, reckon you'll do, and I was provided with a foolscap sized piece of paper with Australia at the top of it in large red letters, which directed any recruiting station to enlist the under-mentioned man into the regiment of his choice forthwith. Armed with that, I did my medical examination and I took the oath and received the shilling, though I don't remember that, but at any rate, metaphorically, I received the shilling at Edgware Recruiting Station. Edgware Recruiting Station in Middlesex, and was on the train on the 21st of October to Warwick, where I, having chosen as my regiment the Royal Warwickshire Regiment, for no other reason, I don't say no better reason, for it is a good reason, but for no other reason than that my father, when a student at Saltley College in 1890, had served in K Company of the 8th Volunteer Battalion of the Royal Warwickshire Regiment as a volunteer, and was therefore, which was my only family connection so far as I knew with the army, and was therefore a regiment to specify. It was also a regiment with recruiting connections with Birmingham, where I was born, so it wouldn't be a regiment in which I should be a stranger. So I was duly met, dressed like a professor, hat and umbrella and coat, off for train at Warwick Station by a corporal and two men, who I think must have imagined that I was an inspecting official from the War Office. And I think there was some disappointment when they discovered that I was enlisting as a private. And within an hour, I was converted into Private Powell, 5110957, in the Royal Warwickshire Regiment, and was on my way to my first meal in barracks.
What was that like?
It consisted of potatoes, faggots and peas. Good black country fare. Good Midlands fare. On the way, I was accosted by a young soldier who I afterwards learnt was a regular bandsman, who in fact lived in the barrack room to which I was assigned. The barrack rooms at Budbrook Barracks were all named after the battle honours of the Royal Warwickshire Regiment, and it was the Battle at Orthes, or as we pronounced it, or Orthes, in the Pyrenees, where Wellington defeated Soult, I think, that I found myself with straw-filled palliasse and iron bed. Anyhow, as we surged down with the mass of humanity, I was accosted by this individual who said, "Who was I?" And I told him. He said, "Can you fight?" I said, "Well, that's what I've come for. That's what I've come to learn to do." "No, no," said he. "I mean, can you fight with your fists?" I said, "Well, I hadn't done much of that." He said, "That's a pity. It's pretty rough here. Anyhow, I'll look after you." And we remained friends from then onwards, as long as I was at Warwick. And he certainly prevented me from falling into any traps that I might otherwise have not discerned. Though this, I tell this because it is my opportunity to say that I was never the witness or never aware, as a private soldier and non-commissioned officer, of any act of bullying or brutality or physical violence. Indeed, I was looking for the word to describe the atmosphere which prevailed in the depot at Warwick, and I would say that the best word is good-humoured. I was with recruits who were the first batch of militia which had been called up under the reluctant conscription, and they'd been called up under the act which was passed in May 1938, I think. So they were all 10 years younger than I was. The NCOs, though not the officers, were in many cases territorials, and a good advertisement for the pre-war territorial army. I remember with affection the company sergeant, one Sergeant Lewis, whose civvy job was cleaning the lavatories at one of the motorworks in Coventry, but whose life had been the territorial army, and a very good sergeant and a very good soldier he was, and a very good training sergeant. So I have to say that despite that rather daunting welcome, I never found other than the deepest satisfaction in my life as a private soldier and presently as a lance corporal.
Was your comrade's prediction that it was rough borne out, though, in relationships between the men?
No, I have in retrospect thought it very puzzling. Maybe he thought that I stuck out like a sore thumb and that I might be the object of a certain amount of rough treatment. But whatever his reason was, his apprehensions were not fulfilled. Though, as I say, he was frequently able to give me a useful tip when my equipment was not in absolutely the correct style.
What did you make of your comrades' attitudes towards what was going on, towards the war? Were they able to understand what was going on in terms of the phony war?
They were certainly not resentful. They were not keen to be soldiers. And they were very conscious of the civil life that they'd left behind. One of the men I was friendly with was a fireman on a railway engine. He was very much a railwayman. And his background was the railway on which he expected to spend his lifetime so far as it wasn't interrupted by the war. They were busy hanging out the washing on the Siegfried line. They were, as I say, not resentful at being called up, at being trained as soldiers, and were not irked by a discipline which I think was probably not far from the discipline of the industrial life which most of them had been living. I remember one fellow recruit, meek little chap he was. We were both sitting on the bench in front of a great fire which was kept going at one end of a barrack room, above which were the drums and some of the colours, at any rate the names of the peninsula battles. There was a sense in those barracks, though they no doubt only dated from the Caldwell reforms, there was a sense in those barracks that I strongly had that I had rejoined the army of a peninsula war. It was the professional army. It was the army of a series of professional soldiers' wars. And there's a passage in Carlyle when he says, "What would we not give to meet alive one of the hypaspists of Alexander?" Well, at least I felt I had just known before it disappeared forever the army of Wellington. Anyhow, we were sitting on this bench in front of a blazing fire, which I think must have been the only form of heating in that long barrack room, and he was burnishing his bayonet, which he did quite lovingly. And as he finished, he said to me, in a mild, reflective sort of way, "I don't want to go home till I've stuck that into a jerry." Another recollection I have is of a recruit who earned the wrath of the weapon training officer because he couldn't get out of a habit of referring to the muzzle of his gun as the nozzle, he having no doubt been much more acquainted with nozzles than with muzzles. Of my relations with my fellow privates, two things stuck in my memory. First is, and this was a lesson for life, I wanted to be a general. I wanted to end the war, so to speak, no, perhaps not so to speak, riding into Berlin on a white horse. I wanted promotion. I wanted to get on. I wanted rank. I wanted authority. The lesson I learned was that they didn't. But they were very glad if somebody was prepared to take on any degree of responsibility. That most of the privates didn't want to be colour sergeants and didn't want to be majors or colonels came as an utter astonishment to me. All my life, from a competitive school days, in a competitive school, I'd assumed that all life was about competition and that everybody wanted to get on. I found myself amongst men who were quite content when markers were called for, that Private Powell was the right-hand marker. They expected Powell to be the right-hand marker. They were pleased that Powell was the right-hand marker. And when in due course Private Powell became Lance Corporal Powell, they were gratified that this was so, instead of being, as I had supposed, envious and irritable.
But did you think any less of them because they weren't ambitious?
No, I didn't think less of them. I'd learnt a lesson. I had learnt something about my fellow men. Indeed, I'd probably learnt something about myself. And the day that I became a Lance Corporal, we had already moved out of barracks to presumably our second stage of initial training. And we were encamped on the concrete in the buildings at Warwick Racecourse, where we slept on our blankets on the concrete through the cold winter of 39-40. Every morning at reveille, a broom would be handed round, and each private would sweep the space in which his blankets had been, and his part of a barrack room, until after the broom had done the round, the barrack room would have been completely swept. I took the broom from the next man to me automatically, and it was pulled out of my hands. "You don't do that now, Mr. Powell." They call me Mr. Powell. They always call me Mr. Powell. "You don't do that now, Mr. Powell. You're a corporal." And they took my blankets and pulled them into the corporal's bunk. Now, I must explain the corporal's bunk. There was, off this room in the racecourse buildings, a smaller room, a very small room, which I take to have been ticket office or the like. It was just about big enough to contain the corporal and his bed. But it was thought necessary and insisted upon by my fellows that I should be given the class distinction of at least my head being inside the corporal's bunk when my blankets were laid out for sleeping. That night I went over to the NCO's mess. I walked across to the NCO's mess in the depot, and I was greeted by the PT RSM, a very smart man indeed he was, who came up to me at once. "Said, Corporal Powell, I'm glad to see you have your stripe up. I'm glad you're not going to be ordered about by us anymore." Now, that sounds horribly inverted snobby, but it wasn't. It was the most natural thing in the world, and so kindly and generously meant. I suppose there must have been some sense amongst the NCOs and even amongst the officers, but I was playing that I was taking my part as a private, and taking it, as indeed I had no difficulty in taking it, as a private should take it.
Were you a smart soldier?
Sergeant Lewis told the CO that I was the smartest man in the company, which I regard as one of the highest distinctions that I've ever received. The NCO certainly wanted me to get on. The platoon corporal was particularly anxious that I shouldn't lose any points, and I remember him one day running after me when I went on to parades, saying, Mr. Powell, the knob of your rifle, the knob of your boat is up," which corporals don't, which is not terms in which corporals generally address privates who are going improperly accoutred on parade. And the weapon training sergeant was very anxious that my shooting should be better than it was, and it certainly was rotten. He mistakenly thinking that my shooting would be one of the accomplishments which would count for me in being commissioned or in subsequent advancement, that being his own horizon. And he allowed me and encouraged me to use his bunk, because he had his own bunk at the end of the armory, and go in there and read field service manuals and manuals on weapons. And he gave me extra time on the range to improve shooting, which always remained awful. And I remember one day I was there, and he and the weapon training officer, Second Lieutenant Salmon, came in. And so I explained what I was doing there, which caused no objection. And I fell into conversation with the weapon training officer, who said, I wonder where you will end the war. And I said, I shall end the war as a Major General, sir. He didn't dispute it, but he must have thought it rather strange in 1939.
Could I ask you about the phony war and what your own attitude and that of your comrades in the barrack room was towards this so-called dead period?
I think the assumption was that it would sooner or later be 1918 all over again. That we must not be deceived or misled by the quiescence, that what we were in for was 1918. I don't remember anyone saying, or the attitude being abroad, well, this is phony anyhow and we shall soon be home again. This show isn't genuine. The show was regarded as totally genuine. If there was a delay before returning to November 1918, well then so much the better trained one would be.
Was there any sense of shame or an opportunity lost when an attack wasn't launched in the West when the Germans were attacking Poland?
I can only answer that question for myself, because I don't believe that my fellow soldiers thought much about the war in those strategic terms. My own view was that self-evidently the treaty with Poland was made in order to ensure that willy-nilly a further military adventure by Germany on the continent would bring us into the war, and that it had served its purpose, and that no one could rationally have supposed that it was in our power to prevent the overrunning of Poland, the partition of Poland by Germany and Russia. So therefore, as one naturally deplored the overwhelming of a people resisting their overweening enemies, I regarded it as an expendable trigger by which the thing so long desired that Britain decided to fight was released.
So can we pick up the story of your progress as a corporal now?
I didn't progress much as a corporal, because not long after I had my Lance Corporal stripe, I was nominated for OCTU at Aldershot. I had previously declined an offer to be trained at Minley in the Provo Corps, the Military Police Corps. And I had declined, I think, one other offer of training, which didn't seem to me to lead to a combatant war. But I was content to go to be sent to an infantry OCTU at Aldershot and to be trained as an infantry officer, which I envisaged myself being. Though, no doubt, the hand which plucked me from Warwick Barracks, plucked Corporal Powell from Warwick Barracks and converted him into Cadet Powell at Ramillies Barracks, Aldershot, was actuated with a mind that knew my command of German and of a number of other European languages. And on arriving at Aldershot in January 1940, I found that the extraordinary decision had been taken to put in the same platoon all those in that month who had been selected or noted as having linguistic capabilities. And a curious assortment we were. There were of immense variety from all walks of life, and with a total hatred of Germany in that barrack room, which probably couldn't have been found in a similar space anywhere else in the few places elsewhere in the United Kingdom. We used to have a game after lights out whereby someone would produce a word and we would see how many languages we could translate it into. There was Arabic, Greek, Norwegian. That resulted in one of the cadets having accelerated commissioning in April 1940. German, French, Italian, of course, and an assortment of other European languages. And we were, upon the whole, men who had known the continent, had known the background to Germany. There were a couple of Jews amongst us who had known what Germany was about, what Germany meant and stood for.
English Jews?
English Jews, yes. Well, I mean, British Jews. One was an actor in private life. I don't know what was the profession in private life of the other. But certainly no one in that barrack room had any delusions about Germany, though many of us were fluent speakers of German and well-versed in German literature and in German culture. My next-door cadet, the cadet whose bunk was next to mine in the barrack room, was Hardy Ames, the dress designer, and we've remained friends ever since. I suppose one shouldn't tell this sort of a story, but he believed that in order to sleep well, one needed to read a French novel before turning in. So he fitted himself up with a little shelf and a candle so that he could read his French novel for 5 or 10 minutes before going to sleep. And I remember this platoon sergeant, who was one Sergeant Finney, an Irishman with a high-pitched voice, entering the barrack room to find Cadet Ames reading his novel with his candle. And he lifted up in his voice and said, "You gentlemen are not being fair to me. I don't mind you gentlemen having a candle to undress by, but to use a candle to read by, you're not being unfair to me." The candle was put out. My recollection of being a cadet is very different from my recollection of being a private soldier or a lance corporal. As a private soldier and a lance corporal, you knew what you were. But an officer cadet is neither one thing nor the other. He's going to be an officer, but he isn't. He no longer is a private soldier and isn't. And this twilight existence, I think, was very irksome to those, though it was only 4 months out of our lives, who awaited commissioning with great impatience, and who found, though it was not unreasonable, the discipline of the Aldershot unit irksome in the way that the discipline of the infantry barrack had not been. I think one of the factors in this was that we were very conscious that most of the officers knew no more about war than we did. There was a great contrast between the officers who had been in the First War and those who had not. In 164 OCTU, there were only 2 officers, to my knowledge. There was, certainly I was only concerned with 2 such officers. One was the company commander, Major Foster of the Queen's Regiment, and the other was the Colonel Bingham, the commanding officer of the unit. And there was an extraordinary difference between one's whole relationship and what one learnt from those men and one's relationship with the other instructors.